Gilbert and Sullivan operettas are among the most popular form of musical theater, but surprisingly few of them have been filmed. Criterion has just released two films that classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says are indispensable to anyone who already loves Gilbert and Sullivan and might very well make new fans out of those who don't.
Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, in case you don't know them, are not only tuneful and hilarious, they're also very touching and truly literate. The most popular and surely the funniest is the Mikado, a satire not so much of Japanese customs, but of English customs filtered through a Japanese lens. Oddly, Hollywood didn't touch it until half a century after its premiere at London's Savoy Theatre, in 1939, when it was also being jazzed up on stage in such pieces as Michael Todd's The Hot Mikado, starring Bill Bojangles Robinson. The Hollywood version, directed by Victor Schertzinger, who was also a songwriter, is a Technicolor extravaganza, maybe a little too pastel for Gilbert's wicked jokes about greed, self-interest, conformity, and torture. Unfortunately, some of the most delightful and most serious numbers were left out of the film to make room for a silly and unnecessary prologue that expands the role of the weakest cast member, the American tenor Kenny Baker, a pretty boy with a pretty voice and, shall we say, limited acting skills. Still, the film is a wonderful record of such legendary doily cart stars as Martin Green, who plays Coco, the cheap tailor, who has become the Lord High Executioner because in this topsy-turvy world, he was next in line to be beheaded for flirting. Coco's most famous patter song is cut in most versions of the film, probably because the original lyric included what was in 19th century England a slang theatrical term, but is now a racial slur. But Criterion has preserved it on a bonus track. This excerpt comes before the offending passage.
As someday it may happen that a victim must be found, I've got a little list of society offenders who might well be underground and who never would be missed. There's the pestilential nuisances who write for autographs, all people who have flabby hands and irritating laughs, all children who are up in dates and floor you with them flat, all people who on shake hands with you like that. And all third persons who on spoiling tete-a-tetes insist, they'd none of them be missed.
He's got them on the list, and they'll none of them be missed,
The other G&S film that's just been reissued is Topsy Turvy. Not an operetta, but the British director Mike Leigh's 1999 fictionalized account of the creation of the Mikado. And it may be the best film ever made about the creative process, and especially the torments of collaboration. The composer and the librettist have come to an impasse. Gilbert seems stuck in an old mold, in which a tangled plot gets resolved only through some sort of magic potion. Sullivan has higher aspirations, to compose a grand opera, and he won't compromise by setting to music a trivial comedy he doesn't believe in. Gilbert's wife tries to shake him out of his lethargy by taking him to an exhibition of Japanese culture. He brings home a Japanese sword that he hangs over his study door, and when it crashes to the floor, voila, the Mikado. Mike Leigh's sense of history is totally convincing, except that, as one of the G&S scholars on the alternate DVD soundtrack indicates, that famous Japanese exhibition didn't actually come to London until after the Mikado was produced. Still, the story of the sword is legendary, and Leigh has a breathtaking eye for period detail and customs, the addictions and affectations of performers, the controlled desperation of producers, and especially the tensions of the rehearsal process.
Mikado has left Grosvenor.
Well, another fine mess you've got us into.
No, Grosvenor. My line is a nice mess you've got us into, and I should be much obliged if you would play it comme ça. Well, a nice mess you've got us into.
Righto, sir.
Well.
No, well.
Well, a nice mess you've got us into. With your nodding head and the deference due to a man of pedigree.
Mr. Grosmith, you are under sentence of death by something lingering, either boiling oil or melted lead. Kindly bear that in mind. Thank you.
Well, a nice mess you've got us into with your nodding head and the deference due to a man of pedigree.
Merely corroborative detail intended to give artistic verisimilitude to a bald and unconvincing narrative.
No, Barrington, an otherwise bald and unconvincing narrative.
Was that incorrect? I do beg your pardon.
No, sir. It has only just occurred to me.
To an otherwise bald and unconvincing narrative.
Much better.
Lee gets infinitely nuanced and poignant performances, not only from the two major protagonists, played by Jim Broadbent and Alan Carduner, but from everyone down to the most fleeting extra. You don't have to be a Gilbert and Sullivan fanatic to be enthralled by this complex and gripping depiction of geniuses at work.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. His most recent book is a new edition of Elizabeth Bishop's prose. He reviewed the 1939 film version of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado and Mike Leigh's 1999 film Topsy-Turvy, both released on Criterion DVDs and Blu-rays. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Born to Run, which features a famous saxophone solo by Clarence Clemons. We were so sorry to hear about his death Saturday.
When they let me in, I want to be your friend. I want to guard your dreams and visions. Just wrap your legs around these velvet rims and strap your hands across my
Book critic Maureen Corrigan has just read Ann Patchett's new novel, State of Wonder, and she says it's a knockout that will leave readers appreciative of the uncharted, both in terms of geography and literature.
It's not often that a novel leaves me temporarily speechless, but Ann Patchett's new novel isn't called State of Wonder for nothing, because that's exactly the state I've been in ever since I first opened it. The numbness has worn off a little by now, but for days, all I could say to friends who asked me about it was the one-word review, wow. If you're familiar with Patchett's work, particularly her most famous novel, Bel Canto, you know that her imagination roams far afield without sacrificing authenticity or lyrical power. The idea of terrorists invading the South American estate of an opera-loving Japanese businessman sounds like a premise for a disposable thriller. In Patchett's hands, of course, it turned out to be a riveting meditation on how love can reveal itself in unexpected human and artistic forms. State of Wonder revisits the South American locale and even features a key scene that takes place in the Manaus Opera House, deep in the Amazonian rainforest of Brazil. Otherwise, the basic plot of State of Wonder is more directly indebted to those classic tales where Western explorers delve deep into the primitive, off-the-map places left on the planet and in their own psyches. Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness is the main inspiration here, but Old English majors will catch references to other gone native tales, like Evelyn Waugh's A Handful of Dust, where an adventurer marooned in the Brazilian jungle consoles himself, as Patchett's characters do, by reading a mildewed collection of the work of Charles Dickens. The gist of State of Wonder is this. Dr. Marina Singh, a 42-year-old research scientist working for a pharmaceutical company in Minnesota, is sent to Brazil to locate the remains of her deceased lab mate, a nice family guy who died of a fever after he was sent into the rainforest months earlier to find another employee, the reclusive Dr. Annick Swenson. Dr. Swenson has been in the wild 10 years, working to unlock the secret to the prolonged fertility of an isolated Amazonian tribe. The women of that tribe give birth well into their 70s, and if the fertility chemical found in a rare tree bark can be distilled and made available back in the States, it will be, as Marina's deceased coworker once said, menstruation everlasting, the equivalent of lost horizon for American ovaries. Marina is an ideal candidate for what turns out to be a female explorer tale because she's so alone. Apart from a secret, tepid affair with her boss, the most profound human connection she's had for years has been the daily small talk she shared with her dead colleague. Over half of State of Wonder is devoted to Marina's struggles in the rainforest, and one of the miracles of this novel, at least to a non-nature enthusiast like me, is just how inexhaustibly enthralling Patchett's descriptions of the flora, fauna, ants, and anacondas are. Here's a snippet of description about Marina stepping out of the airport in Manaus and following her guide to his car. The outside air was heavy enough to be bitten and chewed. Never had Marina's lungs taken in so much oxygen, so much moisture. With every inhalation, she felt she was introducing unseen particles of plant life into her body, tiny spores that bedded down in between her cilia and set about taking root. An insect flew against her ear, emitting a sound so piercing that her head snapped back as if struck. They were not in the jungle. They were in a parking lot. Similarly, the characters Marina stumbles upon in the Amazon are uncharted worlds unto themselves. There's a strange young slacker couple who act as gatekeepers for Dr. Swenson, a deaf native boy named Easter, whom Marina comes to cherish as a son, and the imperious Dr. Swenson, the center of the mysteries, who holds herself and her colleagues to an almost suicidally high standard of self-denial. Even with such a relatively limited cast of characters, Patchett keeps the plot twisting, turning, like one of those slithery anacondas until the very last pages. This is a masterpiece of a novel about the awful price of love and the terror of its inevitable loss. As much as readers will surely come to admire Marina for her explorer's bravery, we should also applaud Patchett for her own fearlessness in expanding the terrain of the possible in storytelling.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed State of Wonder by Ann Patchett. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new DVD releases of films that will delight fans of Gilbert and Sullivan. This is Fresh Air.
Finally, there's a saying that you shouldn't kick a person when he's down. But my commentary today is about Anthony Weiner, so let's just say I don't think anybody will mind if I suspend that rule. Congressman Weiner, of course, is the lawmaker from New York, a rising progressive star mentioned as a possible future candidate for New York City mayor, who trashed his career by sending those tweets of himself in various states of undress to a number of young women and then, when it was discovered, repeatedly lied about it. He finally resigned last Thursday after a painful week in denial of how much trouble he was in. He chose to announce his decision to resign at the Senior Citizens Center, where he announced his first campaign for office 20 years ago for an open seat on the New York City Council. He won that race and thus launched his career. Well, about that city council race, recently Salon.com's news editor Steve Kornacki reminded us of just how Weiner won. It turns out one of the contributing factors was very likely his decision to blanket his predominantly white district with anonymous flyers that claimed that the favorite in the three-way race, Adele Cohen, was somehow tied to the quote-unquote agenda of civil rights leader Jesse Jackson and former Mayor David Dinkins, the city's first black mayor. It's not as if the race card came out of nowhere. This move came just weeks after the deadly and destructive Crown Heights riots that surfaced serious tensions between the area's black and Jewish residents. After Weiner had safely won the primary, in which he had been trailing, he admitted that his campaign had distributed the leaflets. The New York Times said his victory was diminished by what it called his hit-and-run tactics, but by then, it didn't matter. Can I just tell you, Anthony Weiner is certainly not the first Pole who's found himself unable to resist playing dirty tricks with race at election time, especially with that old chestnut, the scary black man. Former President George H.W. Bush, a manifestly decent man, apparently couldn't resist putting wild-haired Willie Horton out there in his 1988 presidential campaign against Democrat Michael Dukakis. Horton being the convicted felon who had walked away from a weekend furlough program in Massachusetts and went on to rape and rob. Right now, in Maryland, a former campaign aide and former consultant to unsuccessful GOP gubernatorial contender Bob Ehrlich have been charged with conspiring to suppress the black vote by directing annoying taped phone calls to certain households. The calls implied that residents didn't need to vote because the Democratic candidate had already won. It didn't work, obviously, but what's interesting is that prosecutors say the campaign aide had an explicit philosophy around promoting confusion, emotionalism, and frustration among African-American Democrats. And what's also interesting is that anybody bothered to follow up. Normally, people just endure these dirty tricks or call the media to register their disgust, but forget about it once the election is over. There are exceptions. Some conservative activists are still up in arms about the two men from the new Black Panther Party who stood outside a Philadelphia polling place dressed up in military gear back in 2008. Now, there's an outrage that they haven't mustered for any other voter intimidation cases that I can think of. But that brings me back to Congressman Weiner. As I said, this isn't new stuff, and the question is still, what does it mean? Does it mean he's a bad person, a scoundrel, a racist? I doubt it. But what it does show is that early in his career, he was willing to play on racial fears when it suited him, even at an extremely sensitive time in the life of the city. Nice work, especially for a so-called progressive. Race is such a combustible and uncomfortable topic. People tend not to want to talk about it. But as Wienergate shows, if reasonable people don't talk about it, perhaps they shouldn't be surprised that somebody willing to take the low road on race gets lost trying to find the high road when it comes to something else. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. We'll be right back.
In Detroit today, officials announced a takeover of the city's worst schools. After years of budget deficits and low student performance, Michigan is trying a new approach, one that will focus on the worst performing schools across the state. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the emergency action has the support of the U.S. Department of Education, but many Detroit locals are skeptical.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder announced what is essentially the creation of a new district for failing schools, the Education Achievement System. The EAS will absorb more than 40 of the worst schools starting a year from now, Snyder said.
So the schools that are challenged will have an entire year to get prepared to work on their own assessment to improve and hopefully not be part of that process, but if they are, to move into the 2012 school year.
The Education Achievement System will be headed by Roy Roberts, the same man now serving as emergency manager of the Detroit Public Schools. Roberts says schools in the new district will get much more autonomy, allowing principals to call the shots and control their own budgets.
It will allow principals to hire the best teachers, place, train, and support them, therefore providing continuous improvement based on student need and nothing else.
The plan echoes the strategy used in New Orleans. Louisiana formed the Recovery School District to take over failing schools across the state. The effort will also borrow from a Michigan success story, the Kalamazoo Promise, which offered many students in that city a free trip to college if they qualify. Roy Roberts says he's talking to donors about setting up a fund
to guarantee that all students who graduate from a high school in Detroit will have the financial resources to attend their choice of a two-year college or career training school in the state of Michigan.
By focusing on the lowest achieving schools, Detroit is following the lead of the U.S. Department of Education. Secretary Arnie Duncan appeared by video conference at the announcement and emphasized that this is part of an effort to save not just the schools, but the entire city of Detroit itself. This ambitious plan comes after many other emergency measures to shake up the city's school system, which has lost thousands of students in recent years and is running a huge deficit. The plan hopes to resolve that problem with new bonds. One big question is whether the optimistically named Education Achievement System will truly inspire innovative schools or whether it simply replaces the ineffective central planning of the Detroit public schools. Michael Tenbush of the local United Way has been trying to bring autonomy to local high schools for years.
You have to have a principal with the resources and ability to make decisions for the staff in his or her building. We think that without that, you don't get to success.
The announcement also seems to ignore another recent announcement, a plan to turn 50 city schools into charters in the next year or so. Greg Richman of the National Association of Charter School Authorizers has been helping Detroit review charter applications, but he was not consulted on this new plan.
But it's not clear to me yet what role, if any, charter schools will have in that new system.
That's another complication that's leading some to ask whether the Detroit schools have too many balls in the air at once. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. More than 150 nations are gathered this week at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. Their task is to review safety standards for nuclear power reactors in the wake of the Fukushima disaster in Japan. The IAEA does not have the authority to enforce safety standards for the commercial nuclear power industry. Most nations want that to remain a national responsibility. But as NPR's Mike Schuster reports, the Fukushima disaster has motivated some nations to consider improving standards worldwide.
Business as usual is not an option. That's how Yukiya Amano opened this week's International Summit on Nuclear Safety, prompted by the Fukushima nuclear emergency that hit Japan in March. In a news conference after the meeting began, Amano, who is Director General of the IAEA, insisted the Fukushima disaster has motivated the international community to pay closer attention to nuclear safety.
I sense there is a very firm determination on the part of IAEA member states to strengthen safety.
The key question is how. Amano proposed several measures to improve nuclear safety and to make sure the measures are implemented everywhere. Among them, regular safety reviews of nuclear reactors around the world, including systematic peer reviews under the supervision of the IAEA, and strengthened emergency response systems. But the IAEA does not have the legal authority to make such measures compulsory. So Amano has a delicate balancing act to perform this week in Vienna to urge stricter safety measures and persuade nations that is in their own best interests. The agency has to be seen responding aggressively to the Fukushima disaster, says Antonio Guerrero, Brazil's representative in Vienna and chairman of this week's meeting. The stakes are too high.
There are more than 400 nuclear power plants across the world in the 30 countries or so. And it is extremely important for governments, okay, to reassure their public opinions that they are taking seriously what happened in Japan.
This week there will be a lot of talk about international safety standards, but only national government agencies such as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States have the legal authority to enforce safety standards and practices. The IAEA does issue safety guidelines, and those are certain to be updated this week. But guidelines are just that, guidelines, says George Perkovich, an expert on nuclear power issues at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
The IAEA can't mandate international safety standards, and there aren't really mandated international safety standards. So you have to have meetings like this to try to educate and motivate many different actors to decide that, yes, things other than expense may be more important. In other words, safety may be more important, you know, than getting the lowest cost or bid.
The IAEA director is proposing that all nations carry out risk assessments for their reactors over the next year and a half. At the same time, he would like to see 10% of the world's 440 commercial reactors undergo safety inspections on a random basis over the next 3 years. The IAEA does not have the budget to finance this initial enhanced safety program, and there is some thought that the commercial operators of power plants should pay for it. But that runs into the perpetual dilemma for the nuclear power industry, says David Albright, who heads the Institute for Science and International Security.
Cost is always factored in, and safety is often suffered because of that. And so I hope that the accident will be kind of a boost to the safety side that says, look, we really do have to improve the safety of these things and consider on essentially very unusual and unexpected accidents.
This week's meeting in Vienna is also likely to approve a strengthened role for the IAEA in emergency preparedness and response. The agency already has limited response and assistance capabilities that could be used in a crisis. The Fukushima disaster sent a message to the world's nuclear power industry that more is needed, including stockpiles of emergency equipment. Mike Schuster, NPR News.